Professor Jonovic, in the first two interviews we talked about your early life and your academic career. We didn't pay any attention to your published work. In this third interview, perhaps we can look in some detail at aspects of the content and the circumstances of the book that you've written and some of your contributions to Flesh Fiction. The first three works that I've selected were written while you were a lecturer during the period 1959 to 72, and you mentioned in previous interviews how time-consuming teaching at Cambridge was, with supervisions and the resultant large numbers of essays. So I found myself wondering where you had the time to be so productive in those early years.
I was young, I suppose. I could. I don't want to make it bragging of it. I mean, when I was doing Winfield regularly, often up until 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I could in those days work late at night. I can't today.
Well, starting with Winfield and Jonovic on Torch, there were three editions with which you were involved.
Oh, what's it called? What's the wrong one there?
I stand to be corrected then. I'll check on that. I looked at the 7th, 8th and 9th. Mm. They were all highly praised by the reviewers. I wondered what the circumstances were that drew you into revising Professor Winfield's book.
I was asked to do it, actually. One or two of the senior people here, I think principally Daniel Williams, I was considered to him. And Ellis Lewis was still around, of course, and he was part editor, but I had the run of it. And I think the question here about what was it saying about which was so inspiring to me? It wasn't. I mean, it was a very famous book, and he was a great, very great tall man. I liked to beat him. It was called Winfield and Jolovic. Because partly, but I asked something like that because I didn't really leave an awful lot. If you compare the earlier editions, Winfield, quite a lot. Not a great deal of what we had done. I tried once or twice to try and keep in particularly good phrase or good sentence. And one in particular I recall on that in the libel section, that apology. It is, if you have said a man did not have the manners fit for a pig, you did not make an adequate apology by saying he did. I worked quite hard to keep that in. But the order and method is I think, substantially different in my editions from. But he was a very great man. It was a lot of the first sort of really modern book, the earlier taught books for students, Salmon mainly, which was rather old fashioned. And it was intended for students, and no question about that. And one of the sort of simple technical ideas I had is I didn't want people to have to refer forward. They should be able to read the book in sequence. The footnote that says, see post, pay 4,073, is to be avoided. Maybe somebody said that, but I don't think there's any. And then they should understand things. And it should be a little flexible, but dear old Ellis Lewis, you heard of him, probably. When he was taking part in the things, he got terribly fussy. He was a lovely man, the nearest thing to a saint I think I've ever met. but he used fuss. He came, it wasn't in my greater distress, was not a strong word. He found, a Nova Scotia case that he couldn't reconcile with an Australian state. I said, I'm sick with that. We're not going to fiddle around with that. The Australian judge came to a different approach to the Nova Scotia judge. It's not a thing to waste time on. So writing a book for young English lawyer primary.
You became immersed in detail.
Yes, too much.
Well.
I had worked in the common law subjects, contract and tort, in my early practice, when I was a youngster, being involved in that kind of thing, mainly industrial accident cases I'd been doing, which comes within tort and the statutory liabilities, factories acts, and that sort of thing. And I found myself teaching that, not only teaching that sort of thing, because there was an awful subject in those days called the English legal system, which was boring to the nth degree. I mean, I didn't even know how many judges in the King's Bench for the division there were, or didn't. It didn't matter very much. And I was quite pleased to have a good, solid job to do. And I did it for a number of years. I can't remember how many. I haven't got the latest edition, I don't think. This is the 13th edition by Rogers. 15, not 15. No, it's only 3, you're quite right. Ellis Lewis, me, and with Ellis Lewis. She's only 3, yes, 63, 67, 71. And then it was Rogers. So you're quite right. See?
Well, for the 7th edition, there was a review by P.M. Bromley,
mm-hmm.
and he said that the responsibility for 700 pages of that text, i.e. most of the book, was yours alone.
Mm-hmm.
And his concluding remark, and I quote, is, would one be guilty of impiety oneself if one were to suggest that in their capable hands this is indeed the best edition that has yet appeared? Do you feel yourself, Professor Jonovich, that you had improved upon the original work rather than updating it?
I would hope to send it, because I rewrote great things. I mean, the order of the book is completely changed. And that's why I asked for my name. I know that method, Winfield Andrew, which suggests a collaboration. What I was saying was that it was not a collaboration. For Winfield had stopped at the gas and he died before I came in.
For the 9th edition, one of the reviewers, Margaret Vennell from New Zealand, understood why you paid relatively little attention to the Woodhouse Commission and the 1971 legislation on accident liability. And you told me that you wrote a very important article in the Cambridge Law Journal in 1968, which touched on this.
Well, I didn't actually mention it. I was trying to say, perhaps this could get in somehow, shortly, the whole atmosphere of English and innumerable other systems with the emphasis on fault, which I believed that I was saying that this is quite the wrong approach really, to make sense in the modern times. It shouldn't depend on fault, which is irrelevant largely, but whose risk was it? And this came from me out of a case, I can't remember the name anymore, in which people were injured too, I think. One was just simply sighting by when one of those manhole things, the cover, manhole cover, was blown out of the road and hit him. And what had happened, big investigation, what happened, the gas main had been undermined, lying below the surface, resting on earth. It was close to a water pipe, a mains water pipe, which had leaked and eroded the earth supporting the gas pipe, which then opened, cracked. The gas escaped, mixed with air, became an explosive mixture. And then the theory was that somebody walking by on the street with nails in his boots had created a spark which ignited this explosive mixture, which blew the manhole out of it. And no liability because of nobody's fault. I thought we would discuss what you need to decide, looking at all the elements of modern personal injury liability more than anything else. They want to look for, you've got the employer's liability, so it's not going to be the employer who's at fault in this sense. And it certainly wasn't the victim's fault. But people carry insurance, it's all about insurance these days. So you want to analyse, see whose risk was it. And you can play with that gas water thing. You can say, as between the victim and the gas company, it was a gas explosion risk. But as between the gas company and the water company, it was a water leak risk. And you ought to move along that in that way and not play around with emotional fault. That was quite early on, I think, that I got it. I did actually do that lecture, give it as a lecture subject time in New Zealand, and I got a lot of stick from the New Zealand bar. Of course, we could see a lot of lovely business going away from their practices. I think that was, in a way, one of the earliest original measures I had. And in a way, it didn't get very far. You know, no paid attention to it. But it was different from what I was doing with Winfield, was trying to say what the law is
right,
in a comprehensible way.
Yes.
But, I mean, it didn't have any influence, like so many things.
Professor Jonathan, why is it that tort has been so popular at Cambridge? There seem to have been so many academics involved in it.
Well, because there's an awful lot of cases. There were.
I mean, would you say it's been a speciality at Cambridge?
No.
Not particularly.
Because it's not a specialised subject.
Right.
It's everybody's subject.
I see. So, why did you stop writing work on
got bored. I wanted, as I said earlier, I wanted to change. To do something else.
Is this when you spoke to Professor Hansen?
Yes.
And he advised you to go to Mexico?
Well, that was part of it. It was really, in the way of beginning things, I went off Gerard. I haven't been very recently, but I went to Mexico a great deal.
You, just before we leave the talk, you were an important contributor to Clark and Mansell, and
well,
your contribution, although it came at a later stage for convenience, I mentioned at this point. Did you have a long association with this work?
We were talking with them.
Yes.
Two or maybe three editions. But no, I mean, that was divided up into a great many authors or editors.
And you had a substantial...
I did one or two or three chapters. I can't remember.
Parties, precarious liability, death.
Oh, yeah, something
like that. Remedy by injunction, discharge.
There's all other ancient history.
Still in 1963, we come then to the lectures on jurisprudence, which for you must have been quite an important book psychologically and emotionally. There are many references to post-1954 works and cases in this book. What criteria did you use to include new material?
A very difficult question. I tried to bring up to date what my father had been writing about and introduce new material where I thought fit. Really not intended to be. I had a lot of ipsissima in my father's, because the notes were very complete. I mean, the history of that background, if you like. he had very full lectures before, he took from very full notes and updated them. And the result of what he'd done there on manuscripts was almost incomprehensible to anybody but himself and my mother. So what my mother... I never saw these lectures. I did go to some of his lectures one time on Roman law, but not on jurisprudence. And he said to me, "You might think of publishing these when I'm gone." And my mother typed out in legible form for me the whole of these notes. And I worked on them. I took it as a sort of beginning. And I, as I said in the book somewhere, that I did not include Herbert Hart. Because it would have been him. That couldn't have been anything to do with him. Because the book hadn't appeared. And that it didn't even right to produce an entirely new thing on that. That's partly laziness, I think. But with the rest of it, to bring them to a readable book, I was somewhere, that I didn't divide it up as into the arbitrary lecturer's hour. I had tried to produce a readable book.
Which it is.
Which I think it is.
Wonderful book.
I think it got quite a lot of criticism, being too elementary. Modern jurisprudence had rather stopped being about what other people have said, which that book mainly is. So that's why there's no second edition. I think. Modern jurisprudence teaching is not, which I think is a mistake. That they don't care whether the young men know about Kelsen or whatever.
That's what for me was so interesting about that book.
Well, it is, I suppose, a fairly easy source for the student to see what these ideas of other people, maybe they're ignored today, but as much as history, intellectual history. That's why there's no second edition, because most jurisprudence teach full-time jurisprudence. People don't like that sort of thing anymore.
Interesting. Professor Jolovitz, yes. That brings us just in a sort of chronological sequence to your book in 1970,
yes.
Division and Classification of the Law, and these were presented at a joint seminar of the Society of Public Teachers of Law.
Yes.
And the Law Commissions of England and Scotland in Birmingham in 1969. You edited the book and you wrote two chapters. So what was the purpose of this seminar?
Well, it was where I find part of my story about people asking the wrong questions. If you want to reform the law, you need to know what you're reforming. And it's no good saying things like contract, tort, because they're different everywhere. And I don't know whether this was an example I had in mind at the time, but I got deeply involved in this later on in a different context. And if you take what we tend to call product liability nowadays, the Donoghue Stevenson case, which here is predominantly taught you don't have a contractual relationship as a consumer with the manufacturer because you buy it in a retail store. And then it becomes contract. Well, this is in a way a bit bonkers. In fact, in France, until the relatively recent directive, it is a contract. You have a contract. If I offer you a lift in my taxi, which I'm paying for, you have a contract with the taxi driver. And any liability to you, because the taxi driver crashes the car, is a contract liability. So you can't cope like that. So you say contract, you exclude it here, and you bring it in. That's the only way you can get it in front. So I wanted something that made sense. It's very difficult to do, to classify in such a way that your subject matter of reform related to things on the ground, not great theories.
Concepts, as you've mentioned in your article. Mm.
I said something about this in various places with the SPTL when we met with the Law Commission. And it sort of that changed. Nothing's come of that. Nothing. Nothing at all.
I wondered about that.
But there's a lot of people, quite a lot of people turned up. And it was quite a good, worthwhile thing, even though nothing came out of it. I had forgotten altogether about that. I had to search this house trying to find that book.
In the conclusions, you mentioned computers. You said they could never take over the whole task of selection of material for a particular purpose and would never become a substitute for a library. Do you think things have moved far in this direction nearly 40 years since you wrote that?
Well, I don't know. I certainly very strongly believe that a young law student should know about handling books. And this family comes into this again, I'm sorry. My uncle by marriage, Matthew Morris, he coined the phrase, he said, well, you have to learn to do the law. These diagonales. You know what that means?
I don't.
Diagonales is reading the book down, like diagonally down the page. You must learn to do that and pick up what you wish. You go room, room, room. You find the bit that you want that stands out. You must learn diagonales. And I think it's actually possible, virtually. And obviously people differ whether you like reading stuff on the screen. I don't.
No.
And the idea of computers, they can make decisions, actually. They can feed in a lot. But not... There's a very good... To your question about general reporters and so on, I'm surprised you didn't know about this sort of thing. In an entirely different general report, I had an excellent French report, in which he said you can do, there's a great deal that could be done when you've got complicated planning law, let's say, and there's no human feelings about it. And you could feed in the facts, and you could feed in the law, and a computer will give you the answer, technical answer, much as it can do sums. But he said, that's no good, you have it. It must be human.
Yes. Very good with ideas.
And I don't think the computer will do that. Terribly, computer, the word, conveys too much. I mean, I use a computer, but I write it. A computer which stores material is not being a computer, but is invaluable. And I remember Clive Parry saying years and years and years ago, we should, in the Squire, we should stop all this expensive and space occupying thing of all the American reports.
Did he? Very interesting.
Stop. They're not used by the undergraduates. And if the research people, their faculty or PhDs, they can find and see what they want, and they can get it on the web and print it out.
To some extent, I mean, he was right.
You don't need all that space.
No. Yeah, I find that very interesting, very insightful, actually. At this point in the chronology, you became a reader from 1972 to 1976. Mm-hmm. I wondered whether it was just coincidence that at this point, more or less, your involvement was taught, ceased. Once you became a reader, it seemed to me you knew.
Not really. It was chronology, yes, but it wasn't cause and effect, I don't think. Because the title I chose for my readership was Reader in Common and Comparative Law. So I left the common law there. It covered much of the teaching I was doing, of course, in college.
In 1975, book on public interest parties and the active role of the judge in civil litigation with Professor Capelletti was published, and your contribution was the active role of the court in civil litigation. Very interesting article. And in his preface to this, Professor Hansen said it was to do with the 9th Congress at the International Academy of Comparative Law.
Indeed, yes.
Do you have recollections of attending this conference, Professor John? Yes. Was it a, sort of quite an exciting place to visit?
Well, yes, the Congress was in Tehran, but we went to various places as well. It was quite an enjoyable tourist exercise. But, and one could learn quite quickly how unpopular the Shah was, because and see something he did for us. We had a trip to what's the name, a very famous holy place, not Medina, something like that, which was a 2 or 2.5 hour jet flight from Tehran to go there for the day. And we could sign on for that for $5. And I think the Shah was showing his generosity to foreigners. It was one of the Academy's regular conferences. And the mystique about general reports and national reports, I did quite a bit of general report. The organization of the Academy, you know, there is this International Academy of Comparative Law. of which I were once vice president. That has regular conferences in different parts of the world. And it ministers them, and you find the host, and you collaborate with the host. And the pattern, basically, is choosing the subjects. Somebody is appointed a general reporter, and a few people, subject X. And the country branches, as it were, the English branch, the Danish branch, whatever, it asks to provide a national reporter who sends his national reporter as a general reporter who does a kind of synthesis and presents it in the form. And then that gets up for the discussion, presentation, and the discussion at the meeting.
Very interesting. I wonder about that. In fact, was William Steiner not involved as a general reporter?
Yes, certainly he was. Was there some bibliographical subject? I can't remember what it was. But he was very much around. I knew William Steiner very well, of course.
He was my first friend when I came to Cambridge.
Really?
And his wife, yes. Very fond of him. Do you have any, just as an aside, any recollections of Freddie as they've mentioned him?
Yes, I would rather regret it. He was very learned and very able. And he was a little unduly timid, I thought.
He's a lovely man.
He's a very, very nice and gentle man. And very helpful. He would help anybody.
Yes. Professor Jonathan's coming back to this publication. In the preface, Professor Hampson mentions the notion of a litigant having his or her day in court, which of course can't happen in the continental system.
Well, tell about that. I mean, it certainly happens in criminal cases.
Right.
That isn't that we don't have a trial, I believe, in the continental system.
Professor Hampson was quite scathing about the then new post of the Ombudsman, calling it a mark of civic indolence. Do you have any views on this office?
Well, this is where I very easily find my way into. They don't ask the right questions. And that's a question that I wrote, asked on that Miss Cambridge Law Journal article, what's it for? Jack was very keen on the old common law adversary style. I have become, ceased to be keen on it. The day in court. I wouldn't go really far in favour of that. Really, it's enormously costly. We have to think of the practicalities a bit. Jack was. Did you ever meet him?
Yeah.
He was a remarkable man. And I think he wouldn't grudge his money, giving away money to charity. But, I don't think he really cared much about the poor. The adversary process is they should be able to fight their corners. Yes, of course they should be able to fight their corners. It doesn't have to be by the day in court. And the adversary system is going out there on the... Oh yes, this one. Line from the posture sigle anglaise. Terrain système adversatif. That one is very important. This one. And the article later on the adversarial technique. I'm not a terrible enthusiast for the adversarial process, and Wolff tried to get to civilize it. Of course, the barristers like the adversarial technique, the chance to show off. And it may, of course, there are cases where you do this. If you've got litigants with money, it can be quite extraordinarily effective. The case I was in once was depended on the correct interpretation of the law in the medicine oil shaped. And we had expert witnesses, and on both sides, of course, and the discussion, which was the examination and the cross-examination. I wasn't doing it, there was a leading silk there. And the judge, for 4 days, cost a fortune. And it was absolutely marvellous. It was like a 10-day seminar with three very intelligent, well-briefed people trying to get to the bottom of this. But there were two rich corporations, and they didn't care how much money they spent. And they can't afford to do that. And the other thing is, the adversarial principle simply eschews the question of truth. Truth is irrelevant. I think that for most people, that's counterintuitive, as you know. So I think that you need to work both ways. Of course, you must have people have their say, but not necessarily in court. The fact is that we've had for years, centuries, nothing else really, basically, but the court. But now comes again my enlightenment. What's it for? What are you trying to do? Are you simply... This is, I think, very important. Are you simply going about settling disputes? Because you're not. It might have been donkey's years ago, stop people fighting each other in the streets. But in today's circumstances, everyone is pushing, like anything, for alternative dispute resolution, of which the ombudsman is one. I think Jack was incensed by the ombudsman because it was new in those days. I mean, we imported it from Denmark. It's a Danish invention. And in most cases, it's all about dispute settlement, nothing else. But you don't need it. I mean, if you look at the modern literature and what is settled over the place, the dispute settlement aspect is to be done by anything other than the Danish court. Not simple, but in the end, because it's far too expensive. Everybody pushing mediation. You can, generally speaking, with a good mediator, you can get the parties to show you houses. They were a nice talking to you, old boy. We asked for a seat. We were a good mediator. Take an hour and a half, which would take a fortnight in court. And no cost, negligible cost. And people have focused on this, that there's nothing to civil litigation other than dispute settlement. And I think that's wrong in itself.
What about the case, Professor Jolimitz, of the two reporters from Poland and Romania? Would you say perhaps that the courts in that in those instances were serving the interests of the state?
Well, you've got to know what you mean by that. I have now, with dispute settlement being largely speaking out of the picture, not entirely, because of course it can't be entirely. What are we talking about? The purposes of state, I wouldn't hesitate to accept that this is, of course, this is what it's all about. It's all the purposes of the state, because the law making, the law clarification, some parts of it, for example, protection of the weak against the strong, these are all state policies. It doesn't have to be bad. Because a lot of it is on the communist side. If the state is trying to make sure it doesn't get a rebellion, the policy of the state may be bad. But it's all the state by the state. I don't necessarily mean an all-powerful police state. We're very much dependent on the state in our modern lives.
In your report, page 275, you make a very sage remark about if it is state business,
yes, I probably might call
the courts serve, then this will encourage the state to pass laws to ensure this. Page 275. Can you see this happening currently?
Well, no, because they don't really know what they're doing. The 20th century is the fulfillment of the purposes of the state. Now, I think, I don't know that I had this in mind when I wrote that. But I think it's very important to know when you're talking there about the purposes of the state. Are these purposes benevolent or not?
The present state security issues of New Labour springs to mind.
Well, yes, in short, you pick out the state purposes you don't like. The judges, you can't. There's a very, very, I think, or rather, which I refer to in the on civil justice, on civil procedure, by the former Chief Justice of New South Wales.
Also on the same page, Professor Jolimitz, you say that it's important to minimise the risk that cases may be described by the personal preferences or the prejudices of the
judges. That, of course, is true. And that brings me, if I may, to another thing in here which is not picked up. And I thought it was a rather good piece. The one about the use by the judge of his personal knowledge.
Which one? What year was that?
No, I can't tell. It was the 1980-something, I think.
I have it. The use by the judge of his own knowledge.
That's right.
Right.
Because where do you start? Of course it's important. But there's certain things I try to analyse it, so I doubt that was the case, but I was general reporter. And I had a lot of national reports on the sort of thing. But it's a marvellous frustration, you'll forgive me. One of the people at any conference got up in the discussion. He said, I'm a judge in Adelaide. Now, I'd like to know what everybody thinks about an actual case which I decided. It was a hot evening, and two adjoining houses, people having meals outside. And the plaintiff in this case complains of he and his guests having been bitten, stung by a number of bees, which flew out from the defendant's beehives and gave him some amount of discomfort and had to get to the hospital. Now, this was a case. But, said the judge, I happen to be an enthusiastic amateur beekeeper, and I know that bees don't fly at night. In other words, it's clear to me, what I know, that this claim from having been married is all made up. What should I do? There were no expert witnesses and no evidence that they just tell that my bees didn't fly across. Oh, yes, they did. They stung us.
Wonderful story.
What should I do? Should I get done for the defendant? And there's a lot of stuff, actually. There's a lot of remarks. You can't exclude it. And it's not quite the same as the taking judicial notice. And I try to analyse that particular and general and so on. The interesting cases where treaties are in foreign languages. Can you use your own knowledge of the language if you have it? And there's a lot of Israeli cases, actually, where the Israeli judges had severe knowledge of Turkish. They were interpreting the Ottoman law, which applied to the time. And they used their own interpretation. There are British judges that tell us a lot. Wilberforce, Lord Wilberforce, he gave his own personal translation in the judgment of House of Lords. That if you happen to know French, can you not use it as a judge? And so that's what it's very different to see where you go here. And that, I think that's part of it.
Very interesting topic.
And that was one of the articles I thought might be worth saying something about. I come back, if I may, to my original question. What is the function and purpose of this bit of the exercise? Are we looking at publications making a list? No, clearly not. But what is it we're after? My general thing these days is why? I wrote in the my addresses when I was president of the SBTL. I used the I have three serving men. And see, all legal reform well, particularly procedural form aspects, there seems to me to be, it's in there. It's in there. Yes. Don't ask the right question. What are we trying to do? And if you look at the way in which most peoples, most countries, the civil procedure reforms, how can we do this more cheaply and more quickly? But why are we doing it? Nobody ever asked that question. What's this all about? What are we trying to do? And unless you ask that question, it seems ridiculous to reform this and that and the other.
And then you sort of a leitmotif in this, in your latest publication on civil procedure.
Well, that is, yes, perhaps. There are things in that which are based, they're all based on our thesis and elsewhere. Nearly all.
This is a theme which you revisit many times in the course of your career. Professor Jonowitz, you became Professor of Comparative Law in 1976, and I have two works from this period. I'm just wondering whether during this time you had more free time for writing, or possibly not. First work here is your 1978 contribution to New Perspectives for Common Law of Europe, and that was edited by your friend Mauro Capelletti, and it was under the auspices of the European University Institute of Florence. What was your involvement with the European University Institute?
That was a conference organized there. I was invited to go. I went.
Your piece is very interesting in this work, and one of the points you make is on page 237 that it is unthinkable, unnecessary, and undesirable that the law should be the same in the north of Scotland and the south of Sicily. Can you comment on this statement?
Well, I suppose I was thinking very largely then around the family law, the personal law. And we shouldn't try and synthesize everything so that everything is the same. There's a case for doing it in commerce, but as a generality, no. I don't think there's anything very subtle about that. The more you speak different in one part or another, the law let the law reflect it.
You criticize the too detailed legislation that emanates from Brussels.
I was surprised to see that on there, because I don't think it's surprising, because on the whole, continental type legislation is much looser. Have we got the reference?
247, page 247.
I was looking at it, I couldn't find my copy of this book. I'm very bad about putting back in the right place, because I haven't got the right place. I think I was speaking particularly of this particular vision. Because the continental is much more, I think, than we are, based on the French concept, and you can't expect the draftsman to answer all the questions. That's for the judge, the flexibility. And I think if you look at modern legislation, particularly the kind of regulatory legislation, which so many cases turn on, is infinitely detailed. I don't remember this very well. There's a famous semi-joke about the the railway carriage. Do you know the story?
No.
Well, you take your animal on it, and the story is presented as a matter of interpretation. The man goes on the train with a tortoise. And the question whether there's to be a charge. And the railway inspector says, dogs is dogs, and cats is dogs. But this tortoise is an insect, and go free. Dogs is dogs, and cats is dogs. I mean, cats kind of dogs to be charged for.
Is that true, Professor John? That's a good story.
Well, I don't know if it's really too stolen. I think it's in the jurisprudence book, I think, somewhere. And anyway, you get things when it goes like that. It is an offence to dismount from this train, except when it is in motion.
In this article, you were quite critical of Lord Denning in his judgment for the Stirling whisky case of Buchanan and Blanco. Did you perhaps not like his approach in general?
Well, he was a naughty man. I mean, he was in many ways a lovely man. And a very charming and sympathetic looking man. But he didn't much mind what he did, and he didn't care much about authority. He didn't like it.
A free spirit.
A bit of a free spirit, yes. I did a bit of critical, if you were wondering about too freely. I don't know whether... I don't remember that being... I mean, Denning is very easy to criticize. Was it in here?
That was page 252. On this case, how interpretation by the Court of Appeal was made, perhaps in the spirit of commonality.
Yeah, I do see it might be regarded as critical in Delhi, but it wasn't intended to be. It depends where you start from. And then he had a bit of, didn't like being bound by the essay. He was do it my way. And he's the kind of person, I think it was Bill Wade who said, the kind of judge you want once a century, not more than once a century.
One of the other points that comes across in this article, which you alluded to earlier, is the difficulty in interpreting in different languages and how this makes harmonising quite difficult. Do you think the problems have been increased now with 27 languages in the European Union?
Of course, yes. I mean, it depends. Well, yes and no, because the problem of dealing with foreign languages is increased by the number. It didn't quite turn to 7, I've forgotten. Everybody's awfully suspicious, and the French are even more suspicious than anybody else. If you've got it, it mainly arises in a sort of legislative regulatory context. There was something in this case, I can't remember very well anymore. It has this different meanings in different languages. And it makes it very, very chancy, of course, with people just sitting in the private offices and trying to produce a translation, which is the original. The treaty is negotiated in French. And it does create enormous difficulties, of course, in the working of the. I was involved a year ago in the product liability directive. From the point of view of the European Commission. They had a lovely job of independent expert I had power without responsibility. But the French were very difficult. We had one day's meeting in Brussels when our own interpreters were not available because there was some other more important meeting going on. And the chairman, who was a civil linguist himself, proposed that we shouldn't give up the next day, but we should agree that everybody should speak in English or French. Or French. And the only people who would not agree were the French. And I learned afterwards why it was, because the leader of the French delegation didn't speak any English. He wasn't even prepared to listen to English. And what could have happened, and where could it have gone? I don't know. We battled on, he was overruled, and some rather more junior member of the French delegation spoke in very tolerable English. But the leader wasn't able to express it himself. And it comes back to you, to the, can you make use of your own knowledge? Wilberforce had, who had a French wife and who spoke extremely good French. As I say, he regularly used his own knowledge of French in dealing with French legislation.
The next book on the list is your Judicial Protection of Fundamental Rights under English Law.
Oh, yeah.
And this was the second set of Thunberg lectures, which came out of Professor Hampson's
Did
courses.
I didn't know that. What did you say, sir?
Yes. Did you have any recollections of going across to Holland to give your lecture?
Well, yes, I do. I went with the Germans this year. Well, it's 30th anniversary of Professor Hampson's summer course, Foreign Lawyers. Well, I didn't quarrel with it, because they were rather different things, this and the summer courses. Well, they were, we had them all here.
Yes.
We had dozens of English people, English lawyers, and giving lectures.
Which we still have today.
Yes, of course. And this was the two people going over to the Tilburg. I remember quite well. We just stayed there. In a very nice place. And one of my friends, it's absolutely nothing to do with anything really, to be ashamed of my own linguistic failings. On the last day of our lectures, I did my final one, I think at 9 o'clock in the morning, so I was stopped at 10. And Gareth Jones came in. There was to be a final sort of closing session at midday, 12. And neither I nor Mrs. Jones, who was a very good friend, wanted to hear Gareth's last lecture. So we decided we'd go for a walk. It was a very pleasant woods at the back of the Tilburg buildings. And we got lost. We were not starving lost. We could very easily have missed this final session. Which widened me a little bit. I didn't really want to be written down as gone missing with somebody else's wife. She was a very charming lady, I knew her well. And then I saw a man across the way exercising his dog. It was a weekday morning. And I went across to him and said, you see, very timidly, I don't speak a word of Dutch. You bet I do. And said, do you speak English? Said, of course. And he was charming, very nice. And he led us back onto the proper route, and we got there in time to sit down and have the closing session. And all was saved. And I thought, I said, now if you were, you're in a wood in the middle of a weekday morning, there's absolutely no danger to life in Denver. You're not likely to go get some help to miss something. You find one man and you ask him who speaks your language. When in an English wood, you've said to somebody, do you speak Dutch? I the South Africans don't know what they do speak. I had this marvellous young man who was dead, now he killed him by accident, a junior Oliver Schreiner, as a research student. He was killed in Tavriatin in Cambridge. I think he was the best PhD candidate I've ever had. But when he first came to see me, he wanted subject, and I said, tell me, can you read, can you cope with any European languages? He said, no, I don't think so. I said, you can. Of course, you can read Flemish.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yes.
It's Flemish and it's identical.
All of them, yes. And we should do the whole of Belgium. And Holland and the Netherlands.
Mr. Jonathan, yes. Still on this article that you wrote, you make the point, it's page 46-47, that English law is better at identifying wrongs and rectifying them than upholding rights.
Yes.
You also quote and agree with Sir Ivor Jennings, who said there's no more right to free speech and there is a right to tie up my shoelaces. Yes. This is summed up in your final, very quotable quote, that it is more profitable to identify and redress the harm done by acts which are forbidden than to speak formally in general terms about rights. Would you say that this has been overtaken by events?
Not entirely, no. I mean, not really, because I think a great deal, particularly if you look at something like the European Human Rights document, with all the exceptions, Ted Jennings, you write to tie your shoelace. If I bend over in the street to tie my shoelace, and somebody kicks me in the behind, he's done me a wrong. So that's what it means. All the stuff in the human rights area, I've always been very suspicious of human rights, and it gets out of hand sometimes. And if you look at the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights, you will find not a few cases in which the whole discussion relates to the human rights of a corporation. It's taken on meaning. It's a pejorative term. I don't think rights... I have reference for the English approach. It starts, of course, way back in the middle ages, where if you would take the man, tie up shoelaces, you get kicked in behind. You can complain about that. But where are you going to get... How do you see that there is not a right to tie up shoelaces? If somebody interferes with that right, he does you a wrong. And you can pursue him. I've always found rights very difficult, and it's an argument in favour of a form of oratory to make arguments. It's very much too far in my view, yes. It doesn't work, I don't think it works. You've only got to say to look at the language of these rules. Otherwise, then it's required in a democratic society. So you're going to judge whether this was okay in a democratic society. You've got the rights and wrongs. And you can, of course, you can enforce rights. But it's very difficult to see how you're going to do it unless there's a wrong somewhere hanging about. I've always found that troublesome.
You retired in 1993 from your chair in comparative law, but your written productivity hasn't diminished during your years of retirement. Did you find this to be a period in which you have all the time necessary for contemplation and reflection?
Well, I wouldn't be too high-minded about that. I'm one of those boring people who have no hobbies. And that's partly, I suppose, why I write a lot of these fresh-written things, because it's an opportunity to get something published.
Also, you're contemporaneous with many subjects.
Oh, yes, yes.
Chris Jonovitz, you wrote an interesting piece in the Civil Justice Court in 1996, on the Wolf Report and the adversary system. You imply that case management is bound to lead, as in France, to the search for truth by judges. So would you welcome legislation as they have in France to enshrine this goal in law?
Well, it's a very different thing to do. Well, the French legislation is putting a burden on the individual. They've got to help in the revelation of the truth. I don't know that I would welcome legislation, but I certainly would welcome some sort of disappearance. A case, the Air Canada case in particular, really can't survive too much longer. All the way up to the Lords. They're busy saying, there's a truth, it's a controversy. And you can't go for the truth. You don't have to. It's not the business of the truth. Denning says that. Bingham, it was the first instance judge in that case. Nobody might have known. It was a case between all the major airlines of the world and Heathrow about the level of landing fees and so on. And question was whether some documents which were undoubtedly relevant should be disclosed by the government. And Bingham, first instance judge, said, yes, I must see them and I can decide then whether they should be disclosed. Because it must be better to decide this case in the light of the truth, because we get it. They're not. No matter which way the benefit of the truth turns out, A or B. And they all, the Court of Appeal and the House of Lords, solidly said that's wrong. And there's some very brief, short observations by some of the judges, to Eamon Davies, who said, to argue that the that the truth is brought in gets you nowhere because our system doesn't pay any attention to that. That Denman Davis, something like that. Well, I think it's so counterintuitive. And everybody talks on the whole as if this is the job of the court is looking for the truth. You can't have the truth, perfect truth. It's probably out of reach. But the closest approximation to the truth the judge can find is, I think, a very important thing to do. I wouldn't necessarily like legislation, say, because you can't have the truth. You can't be sure. But the judge would have an obligation. I think one of the tests you can do for that is to say, if the judge is compelled to give judgment when he is of the firm opinion that he has not heard adequate evidence which he would regard as being very determinant of the case, so he doesn't think his own decision is right, how can you say he's in the right decision? And so I coined the phrase of the closest possible approximation to the truth. And it will come, I think, without any more ado. With this approach. I don't think we need legislation. And what would you say? Legislation would look rather silly, actually. Unless you say everybody has a duty to help seek to reveal the truth. And I had a whole piece on that. The contribution to the La Vérité de la Justice. There was a whole conference about it when I was in Paris. And I did a piece. But I did write about that also in a different context. one of the later ones, very late. Yes, and that the one for Lanjouan. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Litigation.
That unfortunately is missing from the library.
Really?
I couldn't lay my hand on that. It's a bit annoying. I'm actually going to ask them to try and buy another copy.
I think I can probably find a copy. There weren't any off-prints coming of it. I don't know whether the library actually got it. One of the troubles with the first trip, I don't think they gave me any off-prints.
Oh.
The first part is sort of a very personal part of it, and the approach for everything else is in English.
Professor Jolovic, you also were with Van Rea, an editor of a book called Recourse Against Judgments in the European Union, and you didn't discuss in this, in your piece, the prospects of the proposed new Supreme Court in the UK. Mm. What are your views on this court?
Total waste of money. Total, absolute waste of money, absurd. It's nothing to do with this. I mean, it won't make any difference in that respect. It's going to be separate from the House of Lords.
I wondered about that. Is there, in other words, it seems to me anything that will probably hear more cases in the House of Lords.
Maybe. I don't know. It's not going to be a Supreme Court in the sense of any constitutional court like the Americans. And Bingham, I was sort of surprised was waiting on it, because I think if you ask anybody, well, if you ask people who know already, is this part of the legislature? Notionally, yes. Practice, not. If you ask somebody who didn't know anything about it, who wouldn't know what they're talking about, and they don't know which is the highest court in the land in terms of final appeal, and would they be troubled by the fact that they were notionally a committee of the House of Lords? Not in the least. I don't know why Tom Bingham was so keen on it. They won't have any more power than the existing House of Lords. An immense amount of money is coming in. It's going to happen later this year, I think.
Yes.
Madness.
We're coming to your 2000 work on civil procedure, and I wonder what moved you to write this. Was it because you had time to look back upon your...
I had an idea, slightly different ideas about producing a book. I had what I thought was a very good title when it came to it. Civil Procedure, a Comparative Instruction. Trying to use comparative law right at the very beginning, but it didn't really work out. I wrote a lot of chapters and had one satisfied with them. And then what I decided in the end to do was to take a number of mine, and they're not all of them, some of them are original, but basically to base the individual chapter or whatever on particular aspects of the law as expressed in my earlier publication. Then nearly all of them, I think, they begin, we'll take the beginning of a chapter. Some are new. They were based on the contribution to, etc. And certain aspects of the thing, I mean, that was a big one. Appeals and cassation. We never know about cassation in this country. You don't seem to know. And you can't use words. The Cour de Cassation is positively not a court of appeal. And so everybody is stuck with this. That is the highest court in France. And it's purely on law. In fact, it's
very interesting.
And there's a that's come back again. A Mexican friend of mine who's very distinguished now has got two press shipments online. I just contributed to the last one, it's just come out. And some of these just got continents of the press shipments are so enormous that the Venezuelan friend of mine has got 3 volumes about that thick.
You commented that Lord Wolfe said that his report would usher in a new start to English civil procedure. That's in the introduction of his work. Why do you think he said it, other than possibly believed it?
Well, he wanted to get away from the adversarial culture, which has been very costly and very time-consuming. afraid he's going down the drain. It was in yesterday's paper, I put the site on. Torn apart, it's for 10 years. Disaster, people are so describing it as a disaster.
That was actually my next question, was you comment in your book that you don't think that this has actually happened.
What's
A new start to English civil procedure.
It's impossible. I know Harry Wolf quite well, he's an extremely nice man. I do think, actually, don't quote me, that the reports he wrote are about as unscholarly as you can get.
You actually outline history of the jury system, and you say that juries began to be phased out in 1883, and that by 1966
there were
several juries. Would be by juries in only exceptional cases. But in the United States, civil juries are still normal. Why have they retained them there?
Because they're all in the state constitutions. Which is, of course, not an answer.
You also quote in your book on page 388 Sir Peter Middleton. He said that civil justice is essentially resolution of disputes, but you believe the courts have a wider role.
Oh, much, much wider. And in that most recent article that deal with the Chief Justice of New South Wales and his ideas, and a lot more. All sorts of things come in. If you get away from the dispute resolution objective, and that seems to be so obvious, I can't understand how people just don't think at all about how far you can go. But it is, I think, perfectly safe assumption historically that the development of judicial intervention, dispute settlement, was necessary to stop people literally fighting each other. Now, we may have rather too much violence in this country at the moment, but be that as it may, on civil side, civil courts do not exist to prevent people fighting each other. It's ridiculous to pretend that they mean that. What are they for? And there are all sorts of things coming. And other things are going to come, I think, that to assume, as we all do still, that the parties to the litigation are the interested party is wrong. As they are from always. But if you have a couple of corporations on opposite sides of commercial litigation. The employees, the shareholders, and the customers, an awful few. And maybe eventually we should move into the direction that there's nobody but the judges to take account of their interests.
Perhaps, Professor Davids, at this point, you could perhaps give your thoughts on the academic nature of civil procedure.
Well, I don't know what that means. The academic study, obviously, I don't know that's what it is.
The sort of philosophical or notional basis for academically studying civil procedure rather than just understanding the nuts and the bolts.
Well, of course. How we got where we are, and it's about back to my question: why civil litigation? Why is that and the other? What purpose is it serving? And got to, people get stuck to get behind the Russian boats. And I think, and people should understand one another. There's lots of big coming maybe through the European Union, and Wolf, wretched man, has done quite a lot to destroy the ease of understanding. We're not an old common law country. We don't have pleadings anymore. We have statements of taste. Somebody wrote about all that Latin, which is very soon not be allowed to use the phrase, etc.
Yes.
And the language. You should. It's partly historical. How did we get to where we are? And it's really, what is this all about?
I know Professor Lipstein was very anti the reforms. Mr. Jonovitz, that brings us then to your Fish Grifton, which I hope we can look at as a group. These were written, as you said earlier, written more or less when you'd retired. And I assume that this is perhaps the result of the fact that you have to be at a certain stage in your life where you're able to write about colleagues and friends. Could you say a little bit about your friendship with the person so honoured, starting perhaps with the 1990 Fish Grift for Professor John Henry Merriman?
Well, yes, I didn't know him very well either. He was a very considerable comparative lawyer, American comparative lawyer. I met him at a number of conferences. And I think that's about it.
I think you had perhaps more to do with Sir Jack Jacob.
Oh, yes.
Whom you thanked in the preface to your lectures on jurisprudence.
Mm. Well, I had a great deal to do with him because he was a pupil of my father's in University College, and Poppy was his pupil at the bar. He's not family, but he's very close to family, who was.
Gina Gorla?
He was a very considerable Italian. That was a three-volume affair. This is a very short little piece about too many presidents. Gordon Slim was my pupil. He died the other day.
Did you know Professor Arthur von Behring?
Yes. Yeah, well, he was over here a good deal.
Contribution to the Fish Grift for Professor Alice Ersoon Tay.
Yes, I wrote that. I had a good deal to deal with her when I was common law, president of the common law group of the International Academy.
Well, I think that all that remains is for me to thank you very much for yet another fascinating interview. I'm very grateful to you. It's been
I hope you can make some sense of what I've been saying.
Most definitely. Thank you. So, I'll switch this off. I've brought this along. It's just the first page in the abstract of an article by somebody called Michael Taggart. And if you're interested, I can send you the full article. It's on fish grifting.
Oh.
I thought it might be of interest to you.